Chapter 22. Mr. and Mrs. Glegg at home. In order to see Mr. and Mrs. Glegg at home, we must enter the town of St. Ogg's, that venerable town with the red fluted roofs and the broad warehouse gables, where the black ships unlade themselves of their burthens from the far north, and carry away, in exchange, the precious inland products, the well-crushed cheese and the soft fleeces which my refined readers have doubtless become acquainted with through the medium of the best classic pastorals. It is one of those old towns which impress one as a continuation and outgrowth of nature, as much as the nests of the bower birds, or the winding galleries of the white ants. A town which carries the traces of its long growth and history like a millennial tree, and has sprung up and developed in the same spot between the river and the low hill from the time when the Roman legions turned their backs on it from the camp on the hillside, and the long-haired sea kings came up the river and looked with fierce, eager eyes at the fatness of the land. It is a town familiar with forgotten years. The shadow of the Saxon hero king still walks there fitfully, reviewing the scenes of his youth and love time, and is met by the gloomier shadow of the dreadful heathen Dane, who was stabbed in the midst of his warriors by the sword of an invisible avenger, and who rises on autumn evenings like a white mist from his tumulus on the hill, and hovers in the court of the old hall by the riverside, the spot where he was thus miraculously slain in the days before the old hall was built. It was the Normans who began to build that fine old hall, which is, like the town, telling of the thoughts and hands of widely sundered generations. But it is all so old, that we look with loving pardon at its inconsistencies, and are well content that they who built the stone oriel, and they who built the Gothic facade, and towers of finest small brickwork with the trefoil ornament, and the windows and battlements defined with stone, did not sacrilegiously pull down the ancient half-timbered body with its oak-roofed banqueting hall. But older even than this old hall is perhaps the bit of wall now built into the belfry of the parish church, and said to be a remnant of the original chapel dedicated to St. Ogg, the patron saint of this ancient town, of whose history I possess several manuscript versions. I incline to the briefest, since, if it should not be wholly true, it is at least likely to contain the least falsehood. O Ogg the son of Beorl, says my private hagiographer, was a boatman who gained a scanty living by ferrying passengers across the river Floss. And it came to pass, one evening when the winds were high, that there sat moaning by the brink of the river a woman with a child in her arms. And she was clad in rags, and had a worn and withered look, and she craved to be rowed across the river. And the men thereabout questioned her, and said, Wherefore dost thou desire to cross the river? Tarry till the morning, and take shelter here for the night, so shalt thou be wise and not foolish. ... Still she went on to mourn and crave. But Ogg the son of Beorl came up and said, I will ferry thee across. It is enough that thy heart needs it. ... And he ferried her across. And it came to pass, when she stepped ashore, that her rags were turned into robes of flowing white, and her face became bright with exceeding beauty, and there was a glory around it, so that she shed a light on the water like the moon in its brightness. And she said, Ogg, the son of Beorl, thou art blessed in that thou didst not question and wrangle with the heart's need, but wast smitten with pity, and didst straightway relieve the same. And from henceforth whoso steps into thy boat shall be in no peril from the storm, and whenever it puts forth to the rescue, it shall save the lives both of men and beasts. ... And when the floods came, many were saved by reason of that blessing on the boat. But when Ogg the son of Beorl died, behold, in the parting of his soul, the boat loosed itself from its moorings, and was floated with the ebbing tide in great swiftness to the ocean, and was seen no more. Yet it was witnessed in the floods of aftertime, that at the coming on of eventide, Ogg the son of Beorl was always seen with his boat upon the wide spreading waters, and the blessed virgin sat in the prow, shedding a light around, as of the moon in its brightness, so that the rowers in the gathering darkness took heart and pulled anew. This legend, one sees, reflects from a far-off time the visitation of the floods, which, even when they left human life untouched, were widely fatal to the helpless cattle, and swept as sudden death over all smaller living things. But the town knew worse troubles even than the floods, troubles of the civil wars, when it was a continual fighting place, where first Puritans thanked God for the blood of the loyalists, and then loyalists thanked God for the blood of the Puritans. Many honest citizens lost all their possessions for conscience sake in those times, and went forth beggared from their native town. Doubtless there are many houses standing now on which those honest citizens turned their backs in sorrow, quaint gabled houses looking on the river, jammed between newer warehouses, and penetrated by surprising passages, which turn and turn at sharp angles till they lead you out on a muddy strand overflowed continually by the rushing tide. Everywhere the brick houses have a mellow look, and in Mrs. Gleck's day there was no incongruous new-fashioned smartness, no plate glass in shop windows, no fresh stucco facing, or other fallacious attempt to make fine old red St. Ogg's wear the air of a town that sprang up yesterday. The shop windows were small and unpretending, for the farmers' wives and daughters who came to do their shopping on market days were not to be withdrawn from their regular well-known shops, and the tradesmen had no wares intended for customers who would go on their way and be seen no more. Ah! Even Mrs. Gleck's day seems far back in the past now, separated from us by changes that widen the years. War and the rumor of war had then died out from the minds of men, and if they were ever thought of by the farmers in drab greatcoats, who shook the grain out of their sample bags, and buzzed over it in the full marketplace, it was as a state of things that belonged to a past golden age when prices were high. Surely the time was gone forever when the broad river could bring up unwelcome ships. Russia was only the place where the linseed came from, the more the better, making grist for the great vertical millstones with their scythe-like arms, roaring, and grinding and carefully sweeping, as if an informing soul were in them. The Catholics, bad harvests, and the mysterious fluctuations of trade were the three evils mankind had to fear. Even the floods had not been great of late years. The mind of St. Ogg's did not look extensively before or after. It inherited a long past without thinking of it, and had no eyes for the spirits that walk the streets. Since the centuries when St. Ogg with his boat, and the Virgin Mother at the prow, had been seen on the wide water, so many memories had been left behind, and had gradually vanished like the receding hilltops. And the present time was like a level plain, where men lose their belief in volcanoes and earthquakes, thinking tomorrow will be as yesterday, and the giant forces that used to shake the earth are forever laid to sleep. The days were gone when people could be greatly wrought upon by their faith, still less change it. The Catholics were formidable, because they would lay hold of government and property, and burn men alive. Not because any sane and honest parishioner of St. Ogg's could be brought to believe in the Pope. One aged person remembered how a rude multitude had been swayed when John Wesley preached in the cattle market, but for a long while it had not been expected of preachers that they should shake the souls of men. An occasional burst of fervor in dissenting pulpits on the subject of infant baptism was the only symptom of a zeal unsuited to sober times, when men had done with change. Protestantism sat at ease, unmindful of schisms, careless of proselytism. Dissent was an inheritance along with a superior pew and a business connection, and churchmanship only wondered contemptuously at dissent as a foolish habit that clung greatly to families in the grocery and chandlering lines, though not incompatible with prosperous wholesale dealing. But with the Catholic question had come a slight wind of controversy to break the calm. The elderly rector had become occasionally historical and argumentative, and Mr. Spray, the independent minister, had begun to preach political sermons, in which he distinguished with much subtlety between his fervent belief in the right of the Catholics to the franchise, and his fervent belief in their eternal perdition. Most of Mr. Spray's ears, however, were incapable of following his subtleties, and many old-fashioned dissenters were much pained by his siding with the Catholics, while others thought he had better let politics alone. Public spirit was not held in high esteem at St. Ogg's, and men who busied themselves with political questions were regarded with some suspicion as dangerous characters. They were usually persons who had little or no business of their own to manage, or, if they had, were likely enough to become insolvent. This was the general aspect of things at St. Ogg's in Mrs. Gleck's day, and at that particular period in her family history, when S.E. had had her quarrel with Mr. Tulliver. It was a time when ignorance was much more comfortable than at present, and was received with all the honors in very good society, without being obliged to dress itself in an elaborate costume of knowledge. A time when cheap periodicals were not, and when country surgeons never thought of asking their female patients if they were fond of reading, but simply took it for granted that they preferred gossip. A time when ladies in rich silk gowns wore large pockets, in which they carried a mutton bone, to secure them against cramp. Mrs. Glegg carried such a bone, which S.E. had inherited from her grandmother, with a brocaded gown that would stand up empty, like a suit of armor, and a silver-headed walking stick, for the Dodson family had been respectable for many generations. Mrs. Glegg had both a front and a back parlor in her excellent house at St. Ogg's, so that S.E. had two points of view from which she could observe the weakness of her fellow beings, and reinforce her thankfulness for her own exceptional strength of mind. From her front window she could look down the Tofton Road, leading out of St. Ogg's, and note the growing tendency to adding about in the wives of men not retired from business, together with a practice of wearing woven cotton stockings, which opened a dreary prospect for the coming generation. And from her back windows she could look down the pleasant garden and orchard which stretched to the river, and observe the folly of Mr. Glegg in spending his time among hem flowers and vegetables. For Mr. Glegg, having retired from active business as a wool stapler for the purpose of enjoying himself through the rest of his life, had found this last occupation so much more severe than his business, that he had been driven into amateur hard labor as a dissipation, and habitually relaxed by doing the work of two ordinary gardeners. The economizing of a gardener's wages might perhaps have induced Mrs. Glegg to wink at this folly, if it were possible for a healthy female mind even to simulate respect for a husband's hobby. But it is well known that this conjugal complacency belongs only to the weaker portion of the sex, who are scarcely alive to the responsibilities of a wife as a constituted check on her husband's pleasures, which are hardly ever of a rational or commendable kind. Mr. Glegg, on his side too, had a double source of mental occupation, which gave every promise of being inexhaustible. On the one hand, he surprised himself by his discoveries in natural history, finding that his piece of garden ground contained wonderful caterpillars, slugs, and insects, which, so far as he had heard, had never before attracted human observation, and he noticed remarkable coincidences between these zoological phenomena and the great events of that time, as, for example, that before the burning of York Minster there had been mysterious serpentine marks on the leaves of the rose trees, together with an unusual prevalence of slugs, which he had been puzzled to know the meaning of, until it flashed upon him with this melancholy conflagration. Mr. Glegg had an unusual amount of mental activity, which, when disengaged from the wool business, naturally made itself a pathway in other directions. And his second subject of meditation was the contrariness of the female mind, as typically exhibited in Mrs. Glegg. That a creature made in a genealogical sense out of a man's rib, and in this particular case maintained in the highest respectability without any trouble of her own, should be normally in a state of contradiction to the blandest propositions, and even to the most accommodating concessions, was a mystery in the scheme of things to which he had often in vain sought a clue in the early chapters of Genesis. Mr. Glegg had chosen the eldest Miss Dodson as a handsome embodiment of female prudence and thrift, and being himself of a money-getting, money-keeping turn, had calculated on much conjugal harmony. But in that curious compound, the feminine character, it may easily happen that the flavor is unpleasant in spite of excellent ingredients, and a fine systematic stinginess may be accompanied with a seasoning that quite spoils its relish. Now, good Mr. Glegg himself was stingy in the most amiable manner. His neighbors called him near, which always means that the person in question is a lovable skinflint. If he expressed a preference for cheese pairings, Mr. Glegg would remember to save them for you, with a good-natured delight in gratifying your palate, and he was given to pet all animals which required no appreciable keep. There was no humbug or hypocrisy about Mr. Glegg. His eyes would have watered with true feeling over the sale of a widow's furniture, which a £5 note from his side pocket would have prevented. But a donation of £5 to a person in a small way of life would have seemed to him a mad kind of lavishness rather than charity, which had always presented itself to him as a contribution of small aids, not a neutralizing of misfortune. And Mr. Glegg was just as fond of saving other people's money as his own. He would have ridden as far round to avoid a turnpike when his expenses were to be paid for him, as when they were to come out of his own pocket, and was quite zealous in trying to induce indifferent acquaintances to adopt a cheap substitute for blacking. This inalienable habit of saving, as an end in itself, belonged to the industrious men of business of a former generation, who made their fortune slowly, almost as the tracking of the fox belongs to the harrier. It constituted the mayonnaise, which is nearly lost in these days of rapid money-getting, when lavishness comes close on the back of want. In old-fashioned times, and dependence was hardly ever made without a little miserliness as a condition, and you would have found that quality in every provincial district, combined with characters as various as the fruits from which we can extract acid. The true Harpagans were always marked and exceptional characters. Not so the worthy taxpayers, who, having once pinched from real necessity, retained even in the midst of their comfortable retirement, with their woolfruit and wine bins, the habit of regarding life as an ingenious process of nibbling out one's livelihood without leaving any perceptible deficit, and who would have been as immediately prompted to give up a newly taxed luxury when they had had their clear 500 a year, as when they had only £500 of capital. Mr. Glegg was one of these men, found so impracticable by chancellors of the exchequer, and knowing this, you will be the better able to understand why he had not swerved from the conviction that he had made an eligible marriage, in spite of the too pungent seasoning that nature had given to the eldest Miss Dodson's virtues. A man with an affectionate disposition, who finds a wife to concur with his fundamental idea of life, easily comes to persuade himself that no other woman would have suited him so well, and does a little daily snapping and quarreling without any sense of alienation. Mr. Glegg, being of a reflective turn, and no longer occupied with wool, had much wondering meditation on the peculiar constitution of the female mind as unfolded to him in his domestic life, and yet he thought Mrs. Glegg's household ways a model for her sex. It struck him as a pitiable irregularity in other women, if they did not roll up their table napkins with the same tightness and emphasis as Mrs. Glegg did, if their pastry had a less leathery consistence, and their damson cheese a less venerable hardness than hers. Nay, even the peculiar combination of grocery and drug-like odors in Mrs. Glegg's private cupboard impressed him as the only right thing in the way of cupboard smells. I am not sure that he would not have longed for the quarreling again if it had ceased for an entire week, and it is certain that an acquiescent, mild wife would have left his meditations comparatively jejune and barren of mystery. Mr. Glegg's unmistakable kind-heartedness was shown in this, that it pained him more to see his wife at variance with others, even with Dolly, the servant, than to be in a state of cavil with her himself. and the quarrel between her and Mr. Tulliver vexed him so much that it quite nullified the pleasure he would otherwise have had in the state of his early cabbages, as he walked in his garden before breakfast the next morning. Still, he went into breakfast with some slight hope that, now Mrs. Glegg had leapt upon it, her anger might be subdued enough to give way to her usually strong sense of family decorum. She had been used to boast that there had never been any of those deadly quarrels among the Dodsons which had disgraced other families, that no Dodson had ever been cut off with a shilling, and no cousin of the Dodsons disowned, as, indeed, why should they be? For they had no cousins who had not money out at use, or some houses of their own, at the very least. There was one evening cloud which had always disappeared from Mrs. Gleck's brow when she sat at the breakfast table. It was her fuzzy front of curls, for as she occupied herself in household matters in the morning it would have been a mere extravagance to put on anything so superfluous to the making of leathery pastry as a fuzzy curled front. By 10:30 decorum demanded the front. Until then Mrs. Glegg could economize it, and society would never be any the wiser. But the absence of that cloud only left it more apparent that the cloud of severity remained, and Mr. Glegg, perceiving this, as he sat down to his malt porridge, which it was his old frugal habit to stem his morning hunger with, prudently resolved to leave the first remark. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.